A couple of days ago, we read a section of Trust in Mind in which Sang-san warned us not to be attached to the One. Today, as we begin, we see similar advice, but with a different angle. He writes, "If you wish to move in the One way, do not dislike even the world of senses and ideas. Indeed, to accept them fully is identical with enlightenment." So let's take a little closer look at the first line. If you wish to move in the One way, do not dislike even the world of senses and ideas. After going through the poem to this point, this might seem obvious, but it's also a very important point. When we forget that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, we can become enthralled with the idea of leaning one way or the other. This is a theme that Sang-san has visited a number of times in different ways. And when we, as he says, move in the One way towards the absolute, towards emptiness, it can, without our even knowing it, become an escape from our troubles. But as we know, form and emptiness are completely inseparable. In fact, the next line clarifies this. To accept them, and I will add the word both, fully is identical with enlightenment. This is the important point is integrating the quote-unquote one with the quote-unquote many, or the absolute with the relative. Zen Master Sung-san, as we said earlier, always reminded his students that one more step is necessary. That's the step taking us from emptiness or the absolute down to what he called truth world, where we fully realize and fully integrate the absolute with the relative without one interfering with the other in any way, shape, or form. So if we become attached to oneness and reject the world of the senses, there can be incredibly serious consequences, which we've touched on earlier as well. And I want to tell you a true story that illustrates this point. So it's not in any way, shape or form, theoretical. This is a real danger of becoming attached to the One and rejecting the day-to-day world. A number of years ago, a man who I had never met came here for the first time and practiced with us. He stayed after practice and asked if he and I could talk. We introduced ourselves to each other and chatted for a minute. And the reason he wanted to talk was, as he said, that although he had never practiced any form of Buddhism and he'd never tried meditation before, he had had a powerful, spontaneous awakening experience, quite out of the blue. I've met some other people who have experienced this. I remember someone who described going to the store to do some grocery shopping, pull their car up to the driveway, and you can imagine something just powerful and completely unexpected happened to them. This second person I'm referring to came and practiced for a number of times. This man said that this experience had happened to him 8 years earlier. And since that day, he said, quote unquote, "My life has been hell." I asked him to tell me why it had been hell. And he simply said, "My life bores me. My friends bore me. My family bores me. My job bores me. Absolutely everything bores me. And I feel angry and I feel bitter about having that experience, especially because I cannot for the life of me figure out how to get back to that place." I spent quite a bit of time urging him to start practicing with us so he could find a way to put his experience into some kind of context, the context that we trained for, and so he could regain some kind of balance in his life. But he listened to me and left, and unfortunately, I never saw him again. This still comes back and makes me feel really sad. So this is an extreme example of disliking the world of senses and ideas that Sengsan is talking about. This balance that this person that was so completely out of balance is what we strive to maintain in our practice. And the word that Anne's mentioned a few times in regard to the talk, that really can function like a medicine to ease the suffering of being out of balance, of course, is equanimity. Equanimity is a quality of mind that for millennia, essentially ever since Buddhism really took hold, has been esteemed as one of the, it's referred to as one of the sublime states of mind. I'm not going to get into it, but it's one of the four immeasurable minds that you may or may not have heard of. The other ones are loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, which of course doesn't mean joy just for me, but joy for being in balance and seeing the wholeness of this incredible mystery we're in the middle of. So cultivating equanimity can ease our suffering by help us maintain this balance as we navigate through the ups and downs of life. And I don't have to explain what the ups and downs of life are. We have all been conscious human beings for long enough to know that life is always changing. Sometimes we feel like, quote unquote, it's all coming together. And then all of a sudden, it all comes crashing down. This is due to this constant change we've been talking about over and over again in different ways. Since we're talking about the ups and downs of life, I want to take a little bit of I just want to take a minute to look at Buddha's first noble truth, which is dukkha. Dukkha can be translated in a number of ways, and Unfortunately, if you ask somebody out on the street what Buddhism was all about, usually they will say, well, it means that life is suffering. And that's such an unfortunate summary of this incredible path we have. I think there is certainly an unsatisfactory quality to it. Buddha gave a number of examples about it. Try to give people an idea of what dukkha is. Examples that we can all relate to, like being away from those we love, being stuck with people we don't like, being in situations we love, being in situations we really want to escape. This paints this picture of constant change. I think the best example or analogy is that it's like riding in a cart with an out-of-round wheel. We can imagine that pretty easily. So since life undergoes this constant change, we will certainly encounter rough patches where the road is bumpy. It's not our favorite part of the journey. But there are also spots where everything feels pretty smooth and the going can be easy and joyful. Equanimity enables us to maintain our equilibrium so we can be present to experience the full richness of every moment. Pema Chodron has a very well-known book called The Wisdom of No Escape. Is that right? Yeah. The Wisdom of No Escape. So if we're willing to be present for all of our lives, and we find a way to navigate through that, there's an incredible richness to that. And we can learn that even the difficult times actually help us appreciate not only the joyful times or the times of ease, but they also help us see through this way we split everything into good and bad, and we go from extreme to extreme. It also provides a wider perspective that allows us to look beyond our own self-concerns so we can be of help to others. If we are constantly bobbing up and down with our own self-concerns, which is human nature, if we're not doing that, we can maintain a perspective where we can look around us and seeing what is happening beyond our own self-concerns, and we can just notice what can be done, what helps. It can be a very natural response just to seeing what's happening. Moving on to the next line, Trust in Mind reads, "The wise man strives to no goals, but the foolish man fetters himself." Here, Tsengsan uses the opposites of wise and foolish to highlight the fundamental difference between just what we've been talking about, walking the path of Zen versus the confines of our small selves, habitual goal-seeking, self-promotion, and seeking protection from the things we believe are going to harm us because we feel that we're separate from the outside world. Here, Tsengsang's wise man, having no goals, is fully available to compassionately meet the needs of the moment, moment after moment after moment. We talked yesterday about grasping, and you know, we can easily see that as soon as we grasp something, we're not free or available to lend a hand. The foolish, on the other hand, are trapped by belief, the belief that they're somehow incomplete, and search for things outside of themselves to find completion or fulfillment. This traps them into an ongoing cycle of dissatisfaction. The next line reads, "There is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant." So here's the word Dharma. Dharma has many meanings. I know when I first began to practice Zen, it was a little bit difficult to track. So the first thing to know is Dharma means different things in different contexts. It can mean the teachings of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, or it can be specific phenomenon. In early Buddhism, the people who are called the Abhidharmists were very curious about what constituted a dharma and what did not constitute a dharma. They were drilling down in a very academic and scientific way to really understand what is essential and what is not. And then dharma can be referred to as the path of liberation we're all on. But in this context, Sengsong means dharma is the eternal underlying nature of all things. Or as Ann Pope's name spoke about, the Tao, reality as it exists and how it functions rather than what we perceive it to be. Ultimately, as she mentioned about the Tao, any kind of effort to define it, to name it, to be able to hold it, falls short because our thinking falls short and words fall short. So we can only glimpse this Dharma, this eternal underlying nature from moment to moment. We can experience it. Actually, one of our four great vows, the Buddha way is inconceivable, we vow to attain it, points to this inability to fully capture reality in a thought or a word. But we can experience it, which is why we practice Zen. This conundrum leads us to the next line. To seek mind with mind is the greatest of all mistakes. And in this translation, the word discriminating mind is inserted. So just to try to clarify what Sengsong means by mind. To seek mind with the discriminating mind is the greatest of all mistakes. So if you've worked with Kong'ans for a while, you already know this to be true. There are situations, Kong'ans being one of them, where discriminative thinking and problem solving can only get us so far. And these Kong'ans are beautifully designed to, after we've exhausted all of our abilities through our thinking mind, to sit with this big question and see out of don't know if something comes up. And through practice, we might discover that, quote-unquote, just sitting with a Kong'an And that means sitting fully engaged in the question of the koan you're working on, whether it's of the traditional kind or the real life koans that we meet invariably as we go through life. We realize that sitting with them, sitting with the things that flummox us, can provide the clarity that confounds our thinking mind. You probably hear me urge that every time we have a Dharma dialogue, but I think it can't be said enough, and nobody's told me to stop. Okay, so now we come to the last few lines of the day. Rest and unrest derive from illusion. This is a really interesting line. This line is talking about distress. Distress, a chronic condition in our busy, busy modern lives. I think our minds have always been in states of distress, whether we're in this fast-paced technological world with incredible change that's apparent to us. But he's pointing us to the fact that the source of our stress comes from this mind that he's been talking about throughout this poem, the mind that compares our current situation to an imagined state of ease. When we're really distressed, one of the things that exacerbates this feeling of dis-ease is wishing it was otherwise. And by the way, that goes right back to one of the definitions of dukkha that I talked about a minute ago. We often blame our stress on outside conditions. Why did my boss put all of that work on my desk the day before my vacation? Or we blame it on an outside condition, which is just that, why did all these things that I thought were so evenly spaced out get changed and there's this big bottleneck? So this, so much of our unrest comes from this mind that's always comparing this to that, what is to what we fantasize could be. Then Sangsan says, with enlightenment, there is no liking and disliking. There is no liking or disliking. Here he's using, at least to my way of reading, he's using the word enlightenment to mean to the one, to the absolute, in the state of the absolute, in the state of our before thinking. By definition, there's no liking or disliking, because this before thinking is our spacious awareness that we can rest in before our incredibly advanced computer in the left lobe of our skull is constantly comparing one thing to another. And he sums it all up by telling us this. All dualities come from ignorant inference. Ignorance, by the way, in Zen and Buddhism is often really pointing to ignorant of Buddha's insights and teachings, being ignorant of, which can mean not knowing about Buddha's insights and teachings or forgetting them. He follows this by saying, they're like dreams or flowers in the air, foolish to try to grasp them. Foolish to try to grasp these dualities. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished as one. Whew! It's an incredibly strong statement. This is Sang-sang admonishing us in this last sentence. And it felt so strong that I really thought about it quite a bit. And I think the way I'm reading it is that this whole poem is leading towards advocating for a radical transformation in the way we keep our minds, a radical transformation. In fact, it sounds, this line particularly sounds like a manifesto. I'd be interested in hearing if other people are taking it the same way. Yes, Paul Pope's name asked me if I would read it one more time. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. As I was saying, it sounds kind of like a manifesto, which, realizing that he was the third patriarch of Chan, may have been his intent to strongly advocate for the Chan school in this formative time and place. Remember, I think we've talked about the fact that there were two schools advocating different approaches. One was gradual cultivation, or at least that's the simple-minded way of saying it, or sudden enlightenment, where the great Sutra Master Day Shan famously said, "I'm going to the south to straighten these people out. All they do is sit and stare at a wall and claim to get enlightenment." When not too long after that, he burned all his sutras and became a great, great Zen master. That's a little side story. It's pretty amazing. So I think what I would say in this time and place, rather than just food for thought, rather than all thoughts of right and wrong or gain and loss must finally be abolished at once, I think maybe we might say something like, wake up and help this world. This kind of points to something I think is worth finishing on today, which is something we've talked about before. Throughout the history of Zen, there's been such an emphasis on enlightenment. Such an emphasis on enlightenment. And it is an important thing. But some people have this experience, some people don't, as we've talked about quite a bit this week. Zen Master Sung San, in our tradition, going back to his warning to when you encounter emptiness in a way that is very powerful, or even get glimpses of it, one more step is necessary, and that, if you're familiar with the Zen circle, means 360 degrees, truth world and moment world. This is where all of this trying to figure out what's on the relative side of the Zen circle and what's on the absolute side of the Zen circle really reach resolution. We talk about these things so we can get a handle on it, but in fact, as we've also been saying, they're completely interexist with one another and cannot be separated. So if you abolish all discriminative thinking, I would say you are leaning too far in one direction. And Sang-san, if you have something to say about it, I would love to hear from you. That's me swaggering from my knees, from my little chair.